welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Good morning. My guest today is Dr. Walden Rhines. Good morning, Wally.
Good morning, Daniel.
And Happy New Year.
And to you as well.
So today we're going to talk about 21 in review, and then we'll move on to some guesses for 2022. Just to start off, let's talk about COVID. COVID dominated all business themes of 2021, but for the semiconductor industry, it had a minimal effect. In fact, I would argue that it was quite helpful.
It appears it was. Contrary to the expectations, we certainly had strong strength in the general computing markets, PCs, servers, 5G, wireless, and we had some other phenomena like 5G units passed over 4G units in terms of shipments, so we can saw continued growth there. There were a lot of canceled orders in 2020 that came back with a vengeance in 2021, particularly the automotive ones. And then there were a lot of systems businesses that were very healthy. Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, they all accelerated their custom design activity, which certainly helped the electronic design automation industry. And they move more aggressively into the semiconductor world. Apple, for example, replacing its Intel processors with their own custom processors for the Mac. We had also the ability of the semiconductor industry throughout this period to do remote work, to develop products remotely and handle customer problems quite effectively. And COVID also created a broad awareness of the U.S. dependence upon international supply chains. That caused greater publicity for the semiconductor industry, created concerns, and stimulated a lot of interest, including among people within the U.S. government.
Yeah, that's a good, very true. That's also a good segue for the next topic, the semiconductor shortages. That dominated the news. We were front page news, and we still are, actually. I think that's going to continue for another year or two. What do you think?
I think so. Well, certainly it will continue well into this year. I would expect some relief as we move through the latter half of this year. Now, some of the shortage was just the fact that the level of capital investment had been low in recent years, and so you naturally expect some of that. But there have been a number of other phenomena that contributed. We've had an accelerated wave of new custom designs, especially from systems companies and IT companies, everything from Apple to Google, Facebook, Amazon, Alibaba, and those. And so that's filling some of the leading edge capacity and created a backlog. Intel's process limitations forced them to compete for TSMC capacity for their next generation processors. But the thing that got the most publicity were the cancellation of orders in March of 2020, especially by the automotive industry, that led to a void in the supply chain when demand materialized again. And that put a strain, especially on older node capacity, where there were no plans for expansion and no flexibility for additional capacity or investment. In addition, there were some one-time events that aggravated the situation. COVID-driven shutdown of assembly capacity in Malaysia for almost a month, and a fire at Renesas. So the result has been major commitments to capital investments, big numbers. TSMC announcing a multi-year $100 billion investment, Intel $100 billion, Samsung $150 billion in non-memory over the next 10 years, and nearly $30 billion a year for memory investment. And then, unusually, expansion of older node capacity investments for things where it's even hard to get the equipment today because some of it's on 200 millimeter wafers, but something that really hasn't happened in the previous periods of shortage.
Wally, you know, do you think we're a little bit of an overcorrection here of all this money? Because, you know, the word on the street is that the foundry utilization in 2019 was pretty low, you know, along the 80 percentile because of COVID. And then even in 2020, it really didn't bounce back until towards the second half of the year. And, you know, we ended up maybe 90% utilization. And, you know, of course, 2021, I think we're over 100% utilization, you know, if people understand how that works. But it seems like we might be overreacting a little bit and building this huge amount of capacity. TSMC just announced that they are actually going to spend $44 billion this year. I mean, that's a big number.
It is. I think for TSMC, which has such a high market share in foundries, it's a little less risky than it would be for some others. But if we look at the history of downturns or of shortage of capacity, the backlogs tend to vaporize very quickly when supply and demand come into balance. And so one would have to worry that the same history can repeat itself. Certainly the big ones, 1999, 1985, or 84, 85, the double ordering was rampant. The people exaggerating their needs, that led to fictitious backlog. The same thing's certainly true this time, but it's harder to do when you have so few leading edge suppliers of capacity. So you can exaggerate your orders, but you can't double order with multiple vendors. And also, this one's different in the sense that you have such a wide range of from leading edge technology back to very mature nodes, and they won't all have available capacity at the same time. It'll be spread out. So I'd look for a little more gradual resumption of normal supply-demand situations, but we'll certainly feel the effect whenever supply and demand come into balance. A good part for part of what you mentioned is leading-edge capacity. 5 nanometer, 7 nanometer tends to stay tight all the time because people keep cranking out new designs.
Yeah, you know, TSMC's business model is they build for customer orders. So, you know, I'm pretty confident that they're going to fulfill their you know, expansion of capacity and stuff. But Intel is not necessarily the case, and Samsung is not necessarily the case. So, you know, we could have some overbuilding. But, you know, I'm very suspicious of some industries. And the automotive, you mentioned, I'm very suspicious of the automotive industry because they say they have all these cars, you know, on the lines, delayed because of a $3 chip or whatever. But that's not to say that somebody's actually going to buy those cars because they build based on forecasts and expectations. And, you know, I think it's really the perfect crime for an automotive CEO to say, hey, we're not going to make our numbers because of the shortage, you know, because there is no body. I mean, it's the perfect crime. But at some point in time, you know, they're going to have a huge amount of chips. And I think, you know, we're going to have a little bit of a correction.
Well, the one thing in favor of continuity is that worldwide inventories for cars are down about 2/3. So you've got to refill the supply chain. Another thing that works to the advantage of avoiding chaos is that the electric vehicles do have a higher percentage of electronics in them and are using more integrated circuits than do traditional internal combustion vehicles. And the newer cars, of course, have more driver assistance and other features. So there are some things there that cause increased use of semiconductors anyway. But I think your point is well taken. Basically, the world sells 100 million cars a year, and you don't get too far out of that, even with a shortfall. So there'll be some catch up, but you very easily could end up with far more of that mature capacity than you actually need.
Yeah. You know, I talked to a friend of mine that works for one of the leading electronic automotive companies, and he said that they build them a little bit differently now because their cars are very software centric. And he said, you know, Dan, we can actually change the chips based on our software environment. So we can reprogram our software environment and we don't have to use the same chips every time. Whereas some of the older cars are locked into specific chips. And, you know, what that meant is that they have, this one company has shipped record amount of cars this year. And clearly it's not, you know, in the millions that some of the other big companies do, but, you know, hundreds of thousands. And it's just a different way to build cars. And it's, you know, just very software centric, which gives them much more flexibility and much more agility.
Yeah, certainly Tesla has claimed that capability and has come forth with evidence that it works by exceeding the expected shipments and having a dramatic increase. Volkswagen says they are doing the same thing, but nowhere near as broadly because they have so many more different models.
Yeah. My concern is, and we talked about this a while back, is that there's so many automotive startups, over 100 or maybe hundreds of them. I can't keep count because a lot of them are out of China, but
Let me give you a little surprise here, Daniel. 550 companies have announced they will introduce electric cars or light trucks. I assure you, the world does not need 550 companies producing electric cars and light trucks.
Yeah. So there might be a little bubble coming. So we'll see. So speaking of China, Wally, let's talk about the continuing difficulties in China and how they affected sales, and maybe darken the mood and the outlook of the semiconductor industry.
Well, one has to be fairly worried about that. Here you have enormous funding coming in, both venture funding and other funding for the semiconductor industry in China, and a desire to become self-sufficient, which isn't easy, which will take time, but it does cut into the demand, which has largely been serviced by the United States. China buys over 50% of all semiconductors in the world, and you would think they get re-exported in iPhones and things like that, but not so. Over 40% of what they buy is actually consumed locally. And the saber rattling has gotten worse in the last year. That's one of the phenomena of 2021 that's disturbing. New members of the entity list, SMIC, for example, major foundry for China, elimination of Chinese venture capital for U.S. companies has slowed availability of capital for startups in the U.S. and expanded it in China. So looking down the road, one has to be a little worried that China, the largest consumer of semiconductors, is going to be very reluctant to purchase any that are sourced in the United States or where the intellectual property comes from the United States. And as a consequence, Europe and Japan will also be reluctant to buy U.S. semiconductors for fear that their end equipment will not be exportable to China if there is some type of embargo or restriction by the Department of Commerce.
Yeah, they say semiconductors are the new oil or something. And you know, when you cut off oil from a country, we know what happens, right?
Yeah, right.
I think it's a horrible road we're going down. And the importance of semiconductors to modern life, I think it's understated.
It's a good analogy. The U.S. was cut off from oil, and now we're the largest oil producer in the world. So if you force someone into desperation, they get very, very innovative.
Yeah. So let's talk about the CHIP Act the U.S. government is adopting and maybe other major fund initiatives for semiconductors. You know, the CHIP Act is $50 billion, $52 billion. But is that really a significant amount, you know, especially when TSMC is spending $44 billion this year alone, right?
Yeah, the magnitude of this is actually beyond comprehension. You think about all of the government assistance the semiconductor industry has had in the past. They paid for a share of Semitech. They paid half the bill for the Semiconductor Research Corporation. You add it all up, it's not even $1 billion over all of history. Now we're talking $52 billion being spent in a relatively short period of time. And Even though it's yet to be approved, it seems inevitable. It has bipartisan support. It has the president's support. So it's very likely going to go through, and a lot of companies are going to be at the trough hoping to get their share of it.
Yeah, I know Intel's is certainly going to be first on the list, maybe. But, you know, I was looking at Intel's manufacturing sites just out of curiosity. And, you know, they have four in the United States. They have Arizona, Massachusetts, New Mexico, and, of course, Oregon. But they have, and these are fabs, but they have fabs also in Ireland, a couple of different fabs in Israel, a fab in China, and then testing facilities all over the world, two in China, Costa Rica, Malaysia, Vietnam. You know, it's just interesting, you know, Intel saying build, you know, USA, build USA, but the majority of their manufacturing is outside of the United States.
Yeah, I think the idea that the U.S. would be self-sufficient in manufacturing anytime in the foreseeable future is not realistic. The only way you would have a hope to do that at the leading edge would be through incentives to a foundry like TSMC to start developing processes in the U.S. And that's that would take some time to get them to do that, although they would be more than willing to do it. They're as afraid of the Chinese as we are, but it would take a lot of time. And as you say, assembly is largely a non-U.S. operation. So while we may get the seeds of assembly capability planted as a result of the CHIPS Act, it would be a small percentage of the worldwide assembly and test capacity.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people say TSMC gets a huge amount of help from the Taiwan government, which actually isn't true. But they also get help from customers. I was looking at the TSMC's financials. Somebody else on SemiWiki brought this up, but they're getting prepay from customers now, and it's billions and billions of dollars. And I believe Intel is one of these customers that's prepaying. So not only is Intel, not only is TSMC getting some help from governments like Japan, of course, they just announced an initiative with Japan to build a fab. And I'm hoping TSMC will, and Arizona, of course, TSMC, I'm hoping TSMC will go to India as well and other countries just for the geopolitical, you know, help to keep Taiwan independent. But, you know, how are these companies going to compete with TSMC, who gets these huge prepays from customers, right?
Well, the other foundries are, in fact, doing the same thing. So certainly Global Foundries is. And that. So I think right now, if you're a foundry and you have any sort of capacity, then money is freely available both to increase prices and to get prepayments. But over the long term, as you say, how can anyone compete with TSMC? It's not like just because you have leading edge semiconductor manufacturing capability that you can be a foundry, as the people at Global Foundries found out when they took over the AMD fab and others. A foundry business is a service business. It's one that has to be quite responsive to customers. It has to be very flexible. It's, as some have highlighted, it's not just standard process custom design. It's almost custom process custom design. And so to build up the inventory of processes that TSMC supports over 1,000 ongoing processes. It supports every design tool a customer wants to use. It supports a wide variety of packaging capabilities. Those are things that you can't rebuild. You have to start at a point and move forward to the future. And so it's a very specialized business. That's part of what Samsung is doing. They're focusing on leading edge, and they're going after some very large volume customers. But to get a broad base like TSMC has, nobody is going to do that in the foreseeable future. And that's okay, because I think TSMC will, as you say, continue to develop a more diverse capability geographically as well.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. The leading edge technology is something we need to talk about. But, you know, one thing of TSMC's financials that I noticed is that the majority of their business now is FinFET technology, which I consider leading edge. So they have crossed over, but they still have a huge amount of CMOS processes that they're going to continue for years to come. But, you know, their builds are really big on the leading edge. But if you look at it, well, there's a lot of aspects to it. It's not just the actual device. It's the packaging and stuff, you know, which we can talk about. But the FinFET era clearly was won by TSMC. You know, it's kind of interesting that Intel started it with their 22 nanometer. They were the first and so successful, but they kind of stumbled a little bit at 14 and let the foundries catch up. You know, Samsung had a great 14 and TSMC followed that with a nice 16. And then Samsung kind of fumbled at 10 nanometer and TSMC just kept going, you know, with the help of their big partners, Apple specifically, but they clearly won the FinFET era. But now we're moving to gate all around. And I think it's a whole new ballgame. I mean, you have the new technologies of gate all around coming, maybe 2026 or so. And then packaging is now a huge competitive market.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. More discontinuities ahead, and TSMC has done very well. Although I'd have to say, gate all around, Samsung is right up there. TSMC in recent years has generated 50% of its revenue from the very leading edge. Now, 7 nanometer, 5 nanometer, partly due to the premium pricing and also the strong desire by customers to get to market early. But we're looking at 3 nanometer CMOS tapeouts with volume production at the second half of this year, and the 4 nanometer is already running. So you talk about the next generation, hey, it's here and now, and I know Intel has said that they expect to catch up by 2025. First of all, that's a while away, and second of all, the technology target is moving very, very fast.
Yeah, I agree. I think technology of gate all around or whatever Intel's going to call it, I think it's an open field. I think Samsung does have some, but they're really early on. And TSMC really hasn't tipped their hand yet, but of course they have it in process. But TSMC won't actually release it until Apple's ready for it. So, you know, we might have another year or two wait till we hear really the substance of it. But let's talk about packaging. I mean, Samsung is experts at packaging. Intel is starting to talk about their packaging. You know, they feel that they're the leading in packaging. And TSMC clearly has put a lot of money into packaging over the last couple of years. You know, how do you see packaging, changing the landscape of the foundry business?
Well, big leverage. First of all, a package is becoming a more expensive part of the total process. But more importantly, there are all sorts of reasons why multi-chip packages make sense. Mixing technologies, the ability to put multiple die on an interposer and put it in multiple packages, to stack memory adjacent to processors, or as Apple has done for many years, flip memory on top of logic chips. The whole packaging technology has undergone a revolution. It's becoming more and more of a differentiator. So I think TSMC has had the most visible demonstration of its capability, but we're seeing an evolution. We have really the wafer-based packaging technologies where companies like TSMC have a clear advantage, as does Samsung, versus the ones where traditional assembly houses, the Amkors and ASEs, have their advantage, where you have heterogeneous packages frequently on a laminate substrate. And the two technologies have come from different directions. And as a result, they are using different strengths. The design tools are different. In a traditional printed circuit board, multi-chip module packaging environment, you have curvilinear features. In a silicon-based packaging environment, everything is Manhattan or rectangular routing. And so when you try to generate GDS2 for a curvilinear feature, it doesn't lend itself well because that's not the way GDS2 works. So moving designs back and forth between those different layout technologies for the packages requires the EDA vendors to do some innovative work, which they are doing. But once again, whenever you have a revolution in technology, when packaging becomes different, And given that packaging is so important, it's an opportunity both for new companies as well as for the existing companies to demonstrate how quickly they can move.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that TSMC, I'm sure this is why they did packaging, but it makes foundry processes much more sticky, right? So you're not able to move your design around to different fabs. You know, TSMC wants everybody to stay at TSMC, and certainly Intel has the same opportunity and Samsung. But so let's close out the 2021 discussion so we can talk about 2022. So Wally, tell us a little bit about the change in business dynamics that happened during 2021.
Well, we had a lot of big moves by big players. So AMD, a significant gain in market share in the server market versus Intel. We had NVIDIA grew its market cap. It's now three times the Intel's market cap at $680 billion, the largest of any semiconductor company. Samsung moved ahead of Intel as the largest semiconductor company. This is the second time they've done that, but this time a fairly large margin, $83 billion versus $75 billion. And we had all sorts of acquisitions in the industry, which may or may not move ahead. Certainly, the AMD Xilinx appears to be progressing well. NVIDIA ARM appears to be stalling, but still could well happen. Analog Devices and Maxim is closed and creates a very powerful analog mixed signal company. So as the sustained double-digit growth for the EDA industry continues, that also has caused a great movement of wealth into the industry. EDA companies are selling for 15 plus multiples of revenue. That's, I think, to a large extent being driven by the new designers in the integrated circuit world. The ones I mentioned earlier, the Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and others. And you simply have a fixed cost base of integrated circuit tool design tools being sold to a much larger market, and that tends to fall through at a really high percentage. So the whole ecosystem for semiconductors, the whole semiconductor industry growing at 24% this past year, it has been a really big year despite all of the difficulties of COVID, China, and whatever other challenges have caused problems for the industry.
I agree. It was a great year. So what about 2022? What's going to happen, Wally? What's going to be the big news?
Well, certainly growth is likely to continue in the first half. We still have really severe shortages, but I would expect that as we move through the year, we'll see relief of a lot of those shortages. And then as the shortages are reduced, then we'll find out. It's sort of when the tide goes out, you find out who's wearing a bathing suit. Same thing here. We'll see how much of that backlog is real. But I do think, as I mentioned earlier, that the shortages being spread over multiple technologies will cause the availability to occur at different times. And I think so much of the publicity is on automotive shortages. I think a lot of the publicity will die down when those problems are taken care of. Are we going to have the instantaneous drop-off in demand that leads to a massive recession? Well, Malcolm Penn has predicted that we will have it because we always do. I think there are some differences this time. Fewer companies have wafer fab manufacturing, so you can't do as much double ordering. We have a larger percentage of custom designs versus standard designs than historically, so that means the multi-vendor ordering is reduced. And most of the double ordering that's occurred has been exaggerating demand just to get a bigger share of the allocation. And so I think there will be a lot of that, it probably won't be the vaporization we've seen in previous major periods of shortage.
Right. One thing that I've read is that investment is up. you know, venture capital is up. We had a record-setting venture capital. GSA is coming out with their report, or they just did, but I've read a couple other reports. I mean, it's an amazing start for 2022.
Well, it is. When you consider that venture capital investing in semiconductor companies was dying out. It hit a peak of $2.5 billion in the year 2000, and then it steadily declined until 2016, down to less than $500 million a year. And then with AI and machine learning, jumped up to a new peak of $3.5 billion in 2018. And it's been in the $2.5 billion range ever since, and projections that it will actually be up for 2021 and into at least the first part of 2022. A lot of that's driven by liquidity. Most people feel that liquidity is not going to be as enormous as the Fed starts to tighten in March of this year. We'll see how that goes. But right now, there is a great deal of money floating around the world, and it's made its way into the integrated circuit business, into semiconductors, and that's good.
Yeah, you know, it kind of reminds me of the dot-com bubble we had a while back, though. There was a huge amount of venture capital, and everybody was buying computers and, you know, making internet companies and such. And then, you know, all of a sudden the VC ran out, and there wasn't revenue behind all this VC and all these unicorns. And then we, you know, had a little bit of a bubble pop, right?
Yeah, we probably have some of that this time. We certainly have, you know, dozens of AI machine learning chip companies that are not all going to make it. We have, as we mentioned before, all sorts of design being done for automotive systems and autonomous vehicles. Not everyone's going to be a winner. So we'll see. But that's the great thing about venture capital. You know, it is a venture, and there are some big winners and there are also losers, and we'll see how it shakes out. The good news is that the infrastructure that makes it all possible continues, and I think remote work for designers and software developers is likely to stay with us, at least for a portion of those workers, and that means that we can continue to generate innovative designs. And there are other things that one would expect in 2022 to be helpful. Certainly, we're still in the 5G transition, and we've barely started the penetration of all the other promised areas for 5G, like robotics and other manufacturing control. We've got new applications, the metaverse. I think AR and VR can be another major one as we move forward, and certainly getting the publicity from companies. And the need for high-performance computing hardware seems to be without limit. Although dominated by NVIDIA, there are certainly lots of alternatives to challenge NVIDIA. Cybersecurity is an enormous area of opportunity. The cost is approaching trillions of dollars. And so the need for security has become greater, and it will be threatened even more when quantum computers reach 1,000 qubits sometime in the next couple of years and can break most of the existing internet security. So I think a lot of trends like that are going to be a help in growing existing markets and creating new ones for the semiconductor industry.
You know, according to an article that we're publishing on SemiWiki, the world creates 2.5 quintillion bytes of data every day, yet only a fraction of it is ever utilized. I mean, do you agree with that, Wally?
I've actually shown that slide in some of my presentations. I don't know how anyone knows exactly how many is generated, but I am confident that we analyze effectively only a small percentage. So there's a lot of data out there that we could analyze, and that's the new data. If you look at harvesting of existing data, going back, all sorts of applications. Oil and gas companies are reanalyzing their seismic data to see what they overlooked when they drilled wells before, and miners looking at mining data. All sorts of opportunities to get more information out of data that already exists.
Right. Yeah, so that quote is from the Kornami white paper, by the way, Wally.
Oh, okay.
Good company. Yeah. So what other what other areas are we looking at? I mean, let's talk about the leading edge geometries, you know, the 5-nanometer and 3-nanometer. TSMC just came out and said they're going to have more 3-nanometer tape outs than 5-nanometer and 7-nanometer, which is pretty incredible.
It's amazing. You think how quickly we have moved from the introduction of FinFET through 16, 10, 7, 5, 3-nanometer. Just amazing. Of course, it doesn't mean that the features are 3-nanometers, but it means it is a next generation. It means a significant improvement in both power and density. I think it just keeps on coming, and with each one, more is possible. People in the wireless business have told me they see lots of opportunity to use 100 billion transistors on a single chip. So we're nowhere near where the imagination takes us for applications. And then on top of all this, as we mentioned before, we've got these major grants from the government, and the fact that this money will be spent, and it'll be spent in semiconductor R&D, in developing new sources of capacity. So a lot of activity will go on beginning this year, probably only barely starting, but as we go into 2023. Unfortunately, I doubt that trade relations will improve with China. And so that's going to be a cloud hanging over our head that will over time greatly impact the both the opportunity and the capability of the U.S. semiconductor industry. We're all on a learning curve. So if you take away half our market, then you're going to take away half our learning and half our innovation, or maybe more. But we still have a lot of drivers in their infancy. IoT, one that we keep saying is going to be power the semiconductor industry and become the next big wave, is yet to become the next big wave. All this AI and machine learning has generated a lot of design activity, but the applications are still just emerging. We mentioned augmented reality and virtual reality. Metaverse looks like a big, big growth opportunity for semiconductors in the future. So I think we're going to still see a lot of public attention even after automobiles are shipping. But we're right now limited by the amount of talent that the industry can hire. Hopefully, universities will respond. Hopefully, students will become interested in semiconductor technology to a greater extent than they have in recent years. And the new area, semiconductor manufacturing, as we build these wafer fabs in the U.S., it's going to require a lot of qualified engineers. So we've come through an enormously disruptive transition here with COVID, with China, with these other factors. But it looks like we're emerging with a very healthy semiconductor industry.
Yeah, you know, as they say, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. You know, I track tape outs and design starts, actually. And you know, it was very concerning when people were saying that, you know, FinFETs are so expensive. They call it 10 nanometer because there will only be 10 tape outs, and 7 because of 7 tape outs. And it's just very good to see so many tape outs in the smaller nodes. And, you know, I think you're right. I think the biggest challenge we have as an industry is the labor issue, the labor shortage. I don't think we have a technology issue. You know, Moore's Law is not dead or whatever people are saying. I think we're going to continue to innovate on the technology side without a doubt, based on the design starts that I see. The problem is we don't have the people. And I'm not sure how we're going to solve that, Wally, because that's a long-term problem. You know, it's hard to get people in the semiconductor industry and get them experienced educationally and then get them ramped up in the field and experience. And I see that as the biggest challenge for us.
Well, the solution in the past has been to go overseas. And that's unfortunate from my point of view. We've certainly built up terrific design capability in India, and the offshoring is becoming more prevalent and now threatened by U.S. Export constraints that force startups to keep their intellectual property offshore rather than have it controlled for export. But I think the world pulling its exposure in from international things will have the positive benefit of forcing more local availability, but a negative of making less of the smartest of the resources of the smartest people in the world available to us. But this too will work our way through. Just hopefully the world figures a way to get along better with each other, and we continue our sharing of innovation around the world.
Yeah, I agree completely. Building fabs is going to turn out to be a lot easier than staffing them, but obviously it's a problem we can solve together. So this is a good place to stop. Thank you, Wally, for your time. It's always good to talk to you, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you, Daniel.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.